You're listening to The Local Maximum, episode 165.
Time to expand your perspective. Welcome to The Local Maximum. Now, here's your host, Max Sklar.
Welcome, everyone. You have reached another Local Maximum. I'm really excited about today's episode, another Bitcoin episode today, an important Bitcoin episode. You're going to love our next guest, Peter McCormick, one of the most important Bitcoin podcasters out there. He interviews all the industry leaders in Bitcoin, from the Winklevoss twins to Michael Saylor to the CEOs of the top Bitcoin companies like BlockFi. And we're going to talk about a number of topics. But first of all, it's probably no surprise that I have been focusing more and more on what's going on in the crypto sphere recently. I mean, I started focusing on the crypto sphere in Bitcoin when I first started the program, but it combines all the things that we talk about here in the Local Maximum, whether it's engineering, thinking probabilistically to emerging technology, thinking about what the future is going to be, and also, like, we're going to talk about today, like, the newfound confidence that Bitcoiners have that we're going to win. And I want to talk more about this on the future Local Maximum episodes, because, you know, this is like the biggest fight of our generation, essentially, is going on in slow motion. Like, at first I'm like, oh, okay, it's a great investment. And then I go to, oh my God, it's going to change the world. Now I'm like, okay, this is like the final clash of civilizations. Like, what, you know, the system of fiat currency has gotten out of control. So anyway, I just spiraled out there with all of the reasons why I love this topic and I want to talk about it more. But today I've got Peter McCormick started his What Bitcoin Did podcast a few years ago. We're going to talk about, like, you know, what it was like to start a Bitcoin podcast in 2017. We're going to talk about the fork wars, dealing with, you know, when you jump into the Bitcoin arena, you get swarmed by a bunch of people, usually smart people with very strong held opinions, and it's a rough arena. We'll talk a little bit about that. We're going to talk about the tension between kind of the old school do it yourself Bitcoiners who, you know, want to be in possession of 100% of their Bitcoin, and then, you know, the new applications out there like BlockFi and so forth, where you can earn a rate of return, or, you know, the question of, hey, is having a custodial service okay? Because, you know, not everyone can hold their own keys. All those are questions that I think need to be further discussed. We're going to talk about a little more today. And then finally, once again, I mentioned this before, why we think we're going to win, the Bitcoiners, that is, and why this is the new emerging global currency. Okay, so with that, now we go to Bedford in the UK, proclaimed by today's guest as the Bitcoin capital of the world, the host of the What Bitcoin Did podcast, Peter McCormick. You've reached the Local Maximum. Welcome to the show.
Max, good to see you, man. Thanks for having me on.
Always great to have a fellow podcaster on the show. I've been listening to your podcast. I'm sure I've heard about it for a little longer, but I've kind of been rediscovering it, diving into it for the last few weeks. What Bitcoin Did, you know, great work. I feel like you have some really big guests, some people like at the forefront of some of the biggest Bitcoin companies. So, and they just have like fascinating things to say. It's not like, you know, you could invite some CEOs on and I could imagine they're really boring, but they're not. You have some like really, really fun discussions on that. So I just want to start by asking you a little bit about the podcast. I saw that you started it at the end of 2017.
October 17, I think. No, November.
Okay. Yeah. And I noticed, like, okay, mine started a few months after that. So not that far off. There was some crazy stuff going on. Well, there's always crazy stuff going on in the Bitcoin space. But back then, there must have been so much interest, because we had that run up in price from like 200 to 20,000 in 2017. We had those forks happening, which seemed so contentious, with like Bitcoin Cash. So tell me about, like, when you started the podcast, were these issues like at the forefront? Did you see like a flurry of new interest? Like was that what started or something else?
Well, dude, the reason I started it is I first discovered Bitcoin in 2013, but I didn't properly look at it, right? And I didn't really pay attention to it. I didn't know what it was. I just traded a little bit on like a trading website. And then when it crashed, I was like, oh, whatever. I forgot about it. And then I rediscovered it right at the back end of 16, start 17. And when I discovered it, I was on Coinbase. And it also had Ethereum there. I was like, oh, what is this stuff? And I was out of work. Yeah. I used to work in advertising. My agency had kind of failed. We had 8 great years, and then we just had a bad year. And rather than like try and keep it going, we decided just to wind it down and walk away with the money we'd made, which wasn't a lot, but it was enough to have a bit of breathing space. And so I was kind of like, I wasn't working, but I didn't need a job. And I was looking at this Bitcoin and Ethereum thing. I was like, oh, this kind of sounds interesting. And took a little bit of a deeper look. And I just said to my dad, I said, look, I think I'm going to buy some of this. It looks interesting. And so I bought like, it was about $30,000 worth at the time, which was quite a bold move.
Yeah.
And then I just kind of like, you know, couldn't stop looking at it. Like most people, kind of went really deep, bought every altcoin there was. Like at one point, I probably had like 50 altcoins, and everything started going up and going crazy. And you know, quickly that 30,000 became over 100,000, then over 500,000, and it just all went crazy. But I knew I didn't know what I was doing in the trading, and I didn't like it at all. And I coincidentally, through a weird set of events, ended up getting to know this guy called Rich Roll, who's a podcaster. He's like this vegan athlete, ultra runner. And I was out in LA visiting him, and I said, look, I think I want to do a podcast. I like what you're doing, and I like your lifestyle. I think I want to do it. And he was like, okay, here's the equipment you need, and you need to go and watch the Pat Flynn course. And then so I went on Amazon, bought the equipment, and I pinged somebody, and 3 days later I recorded my first interview. But what my problem was is like I'm not a smart person in terms of understanding economics or technical things. I'm more of a creative. You know, I understand sales, I understand marketing, I understand storytelling. I don't really understand deep technical subjects. So I was like, well, I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna make the show where I get all these smart people on and I ask them questions. But I could have done with having the show for about a year before the fork stuff happened, because I was, you know, all the people who are arguing about it had been in Bitcoin for a long time and they kind of understood the key issues, and I didn't. So I was just like this kind of like moron with a flamethrower going around.
That's like jumping into the deep end. But the fork stuff is overwhelming, I think, for anybody.
I get it now, though. Like if it happened again now, I would know my position. I would stick to it. But at the time, I was like, well, I see your point and I see your point, and I don't really know which is right. And therefore, I was kind of like navigating all this stuff whilst learning, you know, as I went. But the show managed to consistently grow quite quickly from when I launched it. And I think the reason the show's always done well is, there's a number of reasons I would put to it, but one of the main reasons is just, I just get people on and say, look, I don't understand that. Can you explain it to me? And whilst there's a lot of, you know, technical and, you know, competent people out there, I think there's a lot of people like me go feel the same. Because I always say, look, there's two types of podcasts out there. There's the smart guy interviewing the smart guy. There's Lex Friedman sat down with Eric Weinstein, and they're like going to sit and have a deep conversation about something, and I'm going to understand 15-20% of it. And then there's the Joe Rogan side, who gets a smart guy in and gets him to explain it. And I always feel like I'm on that side. I'm like, I'm going to let you do the talking and get you to explain it. So yeah, so what ended up happening is I got a lot of stick on Twitter. A lot of real hardcore Bitcoiners were, you know, pressurizing me into certain directions, which I get now. But at the time, I was like, fuck you. Don't know if I can swear on your podcast. But I was like, leave me alone. I know what I'm doing, blah, blah, blah. And it was a real kind of like baptism of fire. And looking back,
it's like all of a sudden you have different teams asking you to join their team, uh-huh. And it's like, oh my God, this is gonna create problem. I don't know what to do. Yeah. so where, it's funny. Like, what ended up happening at the fork? I'm guessing now looking back here, just on, you know, hey, plain Bitcoin side, we didn't need to fork. Is it that simple or?
Well, it's kind of more complicated than that. Like, a lot of people still got like PTSD from that, those forks. That main fork could have been the end of Bitcoin. So to explain to your audience, I don't know how much they know about Bitcoin, but I'll try and explain it the simplest way possible.
Yeah.
Bitcoin is like it's a financial system. It's a financial protocol. And essentially I can send you Bitcoin and you can send me Bitcoin. And when we're sending Bitcoin, it goes into something that's called a block. And most people, if they've heard of Bitcoin, would have heard of the blockchain. Well, essentially, it's exactly what it says. Each block builds on top of the next block and on top of the next block. And that's all that Bitcoin is a block of transactions on top of the next one. And from all those blocks, you can tell who has how much Bitcoin and who sent who to what. The thing about the block is it, at that time, it was 1 megabyte in size. It still is now, but there's this block weight thing, but that makes it more complicated. But let's just say it's 1 megabit in size. That means all the transactions use up little bits of data. Once you hit 1 megabyte, that block is full. And therefore, you can't get any more transactions into it. So you have to wait for the next one. And if there's a black backlog, you end up paying higher fees to get your transaction into the block. Let's say there's a second group of people. Let's call them the big blockers. Let's say there's two groups. There's a small block and the big blockers. The big blockers said, listen, we need Bitcoin to scale. We need it to be able to take on more transactions. So to do that, we need to increase the size of the blocks. We need to make it 2 megabytes or 4 megabytes, because that means we can get more transactions in. The transactions will therefore be faster and they will be cheaper. So when you first hear that, you're like, well, that makes sense. Why wouldn't you want more transactions? Why wouldn't you want them faster and cheaper? But the people on the small block size would say the power of Bitcoin is that it is decentralized. You can run a node. I can run it. Basically, you can have a copy of the blockchain. I can have a copy of the blockchain. Anyone can have a copy of the blockchain. And the great thing about that is it has this property called censorship resistance, which means if I want to send you Bitcoin, nobody can stop me. And if you want to send Bitcoin to WikiLeaks, who are censored by MasterCard and Visa and PayPal, you can still do it. The reason it can do that is because it's decentralized. The big threat to decentralized money is government. They're not liking it and wanting to switch it off. So one of the precursors to Bitcoin, something called DigiCash, that failed because it was centralized. Bitcoin is decentralized. So if you want to run a node, you can get a Raspberry Pi and an SSD hard disk and a few other components, and you can plug it into your computer and you can download the blockchain. So the total data so far, I'd have to look it up, but the entire 12-year history of Bitcoin is around, I think it's around 380, 420 gigabytes. So when you think and about it's
everybody's transactions, all of mine, all of yours.
From all of time.
Yeah.
So what's really cool about that is that you can get a
Satoshi
1 terabyte.
Satoshi messing around.
Yeah. Well, you can get a 1 terabyte SSD and a Raspberry Pi, and you can whip up a node. Now, if it was 2 megabytes, you may be putting more data on there and accelerating the growth of that blockchain. You know, for example, another cryptocurrency some of your listeners might have heard of is called Ethereum. That has an awful amount of data on its blockchain. And I think it's about 4 terabytes in size right now. That's going to be very difficult for anyone to run a node. So the two sides were essentially one saying we need to focus on keeping Bitcoin decentralized and everything else, you know, forget about everything else. And another side saying, well, you know, we want to grow this for business. So this big war kind of happened. It went on for years and lots of disagreements. There came a point where there was going to be a kind of a compromise, but the compromise wasn't something the small blockers really liked. So in the end, there was a something called UASF, which people can look up. It's quite complicated. I won't get into it now, but that actually kind of stopped the fork happening. So what happened is Bitcoin carried on being 1 megabyte. Now, despite Bitcoin carrying on as 1 megabyte, other people can still go and create their own forks, and they did. We got Bitcoin Cash, and then we got Bitcoin SV, and we got Bitcoin Diamond and Platinum and all kinds of different Bitcoins. But the original Bitcoin stayed as 1 megabyte. Is that a good enough explanation?
Yeah. No, yeah. But it's interesting to me because I remember at the time when, you know, I was like, okay, there's this mainline Bitcoin, for lack of better term, I don't know, Bitcoin Classic or mm-hmm. Bitcoin Core. Some people like I was like, okay, I'm going to stick with this as you know, from my technical experience, I guess that their strategy kind of makes sense to me, but I wasn't sure. There were like Bitcoin Cash supporters, big blockers saying, hey, we're just a better technology. We're more scalable and we're going to overtake them. And so I'd have nightmares where like, you know, maybe that does happen. And I was like scared of it. I was like, I don't know. Because, you know, I sort of picked one horse. I mean, I guess I have, some unforked coins, but still it's like, I wasn't that sure of myself, and you know, a lot of the Bitcoiners were absolutely sure that their side was going to win.
See, I'm sure now, and maybe that's the benefit of hindsight. Well, but yeah. Like, I look at it now, and I spent a lot of time trying to understand Bitcoin. You know, I've traveled around the world. I've been to Venezuela. I've been to other parts of South America. I've been to Asia. I was meant to go to Africa, but we had COVID lockdowns. But like, and I spent a lot of time getting to Alex Gladstein from the Human Rights Foundation, who talks about Bitcoin usage around the world. And what I realized, Bitcoin is, it's really important that Bitcoin stays as maximally decentralized as possible. There is no specific benchmark, but there is this directional thing. You know, directionally, it's trying to become more decentralized and it's trying to be maximally decentralized. And those compromises on block size were not worth it. That's not to say in the future it won't happen. But at the moment, right now, Bitcoin is still working very, very well at 1 megabyte in size.
So what, you know, I've covered, you know, Bitcoin use in Venezuela on this show. And one of the things I'm having trouble wrapping my head around, I've never been there, is like, how much are people actually using it? Because, you know, I feel like a lot of people, you know, even the U.S. smart people are just like, oh, I can't be bothered. It's too complicated, blah, blah, blah. Even though it's like pretty easy on something like Coinbase these days. But like, you know, are a lot of people really just getting involved in it? I see all the Bitcoin ATMs at the gas station and I'm like, well, who's using that? You know,
yeah.
Somebody must be.
It's a good question. It's why I wanted to go out there because you often hear Venezuela is the perfect use case for Bitcoin. I was like, well, I want to go and see it. I want to understand it. So
you go there and you tell someone like, where can I get some Bitcoin? You know what? Like, and I'm not saying it's not something bad about like the average person on the street in Venezuela, but the average person on the street is just not going to know anywhere. I feel like.
Well, look, it's a mixed picture. So I first went to Colombia and I went up to Cucuta, which is the border with Venezuela. I wanted to see these border towns because I heard they're crazy. And look, it was insane. Like every day people were piling over the border just to buy basic necessities, toilet roll, biscuits, you know, and female sanitary products because they can't get them within Venezuela, right? So that was happening. Or they're coming over to get work. But basically the people coming over are just poor, really fucking poor and struggling to get by. I mean, most of them are trying to get work on the smuggling routes. Basically, the paramilitaries control the smuggling routes back into Venezuela and people are trying to get jobs smuggling goods back because there are certain goods you're not allowed to bring across the border. But I went into a class run by a charity and it was there to teach people about Bitcoin, which was fascinating. But I knew pretty much nobody there was going to be using Bitcoin. Like some of them didn't have a phone or they were sharing phones or they didn't have data plans. So it's a valiant effort and it's a valiant idea. It just felt wrong. When I went into Venezuela itself, again, a mixed picture. When you go into the slums, like, absolutely no use. These people are living on a couple of dollars a year, basically between $3 and $5 a month. Yeah, they've got absolutely, you know, a Bitcoin transaction right now on the first block is like $15 to actually process it. So it's no good. Where Bitcoin is useful right now is within the middle and upper classes. So I spent some time with a guy who runs a tech company. You know, he does okay in Venezuela terms. What he does, he keeps all his money in Bitcoin. And then every week when he's run out of bolivars, which is the local currency, he just transfers a bit of his Bitcoin into Bolivar. And he does that because he needs the Bolivar to spend. but he holds his money in Bitcoin because the bolivar has, you know, has inflated so much. So that's what he can do. So there is definitely a use case there. There is a use case for people trading, and there is a use case for people getting money into the country. It's certainly being used, but there are an awful lot of people who are very poor in Venezuela, and it just right now, I don't see it solving a problem for them straight away. The other thing is that it's not generally a culture of saving either. People earn and spend. Yeah, and most of the time they're thinking about, right, what can I earn? What meal am I going to get today? It's like very much like a hand to mouth. So it's not a no, it's not a yes. It's just a mixed picture.
Right, right. So you mentioned before, like, you know, you were experiment, you were buying all these altcoins. Well, I get the sense from like your website, you're not still into them as much. Are you more sympathetic to the maximalist position, or what changed your mind on that?
I am. I mean, I was kind of bullied at the first. Like, I'd say bullied, jokingly. I got a lot. So when I was talking to a Bitcoin Cash person about to do an interview, I got a lot of pressure again. And a lot of the time when I release shows where they weren't maybe a Bitcoin show, I would, you know, get people saying, oh, you're just a shitcoin, blah, blah, blah. And I would say, no, all this technology is useful. And then, God, I think it was it early 19, early 2019, maybe late 2018, I decided to just go Bitcoin only. Just focus on Bitcoin. I also sold all my altcoins. I mean, I made and lost a lot of money in them as well. But there were a few things that kind of made sense to me with these altcoins, is that actually they don't need blockchains. You know, most of these things do not need blockchains because they don't need to be decentralized, or they are decentralized.
You're saying like the use case might be legitimate, but the application of the technology is just unnecessary.
Yeah. I mean, look, you think about Bitcoin. What's Bitcoin trying to solve? It's trying to solve the problem of government money. And the main problem of government money is they can print it as much as they like. Yeah, we're seeing it now during this pandemic. I mean, they've just approved another $1.9 trillion stimulus bill in the US, of which every person's meant to get like a $1,400 check, right? Yeah,
At this point, I'm like, I'm not even mad. It's just like, it's just like fun bucks at this point. It's just,
but that $1.9 trillion divided by whatever it is, 380 million people, is not what $1,400. It's about $5,000 or whatever. So there's obviously printing that money for other means. And you know, I'm listening to an audiobook in my walks in the morning called "When Money Dies." It's about what happened in Germany after World War One and the collapse of the currency there, and you can certainly see some similarities. You know, you can't just keep printing money and not expect some form of inflation or future currency devaluation. So I can't remember where I got to this point now. So Bitcoin is trying to solve this problem, and the way you solve this problem is you have a fixed supply of money. If you have a fixed supply, you can't print it, and everybody understands the rules of the game. There's a fixed supply. So that's a really interesting project problem to solve. And actually, it solves in quite a simple and elegant way. You know, has the blockchain, that's a way of processing transactions. There's a way of cryptographically sealing those. There's a way of decentralizing it by keeping the blocks small. We have proof of work in terms of mining to provide security to the network. So it does it with all these elegant things, but it's actually quite simple. It is just money. In the end, it's just money. What a lot of these other altcoins are trying to do, many of them, they're trying to do a lot more complicated things, like with smart contracts that they put on the blockchain. I'm not a technical person, and what you tend to find, like, so something like Ethereum, what you keep finding is like these smart contracts fail, or they get hacked, or someone does an exit scam. And I think it's because fundamentally, those systems are just too complicated to put on an immutable blockchain. You know, immutable blockchain of money is a good thing. Yes, you have to take some responsibility with your Bitcoin. You have to secure it. You have to make sure when you're sending it to the next person, you've got the address correct. But it's quite simple. When you make something very complicated like Ethereum, you're creating this huge attack surface for people to just try and hack or steal from you. And it just happens so often. And also, it's just not meaningfully decentralized.
So there was an episode that I really liked a few weeks ago that you did. This is related to what you just said. It's called "Why Bitcoin Wins." I'm trying to remember what the guests were.
Gary V and Robert Breedlove.
Gary, right. And so that started the discussion on this podcast, and it was like, what if Bitcoin wins? And we concluded that, you know, it's not just a bunch of people getting rich or a bunch of new tech at the point of scale. It's like basically a revolution of our whole society, and there's going to be a lot of pushback on that, and it's coming relatively soon. It's not like 50 years in the future. It's probably not 20 years in the future. It's probably closer than that. So, I mean, I don't expect you to predict the future, but I was like, what kind of massive changes should we be on the lookout for here?
How do you think about this? It's a great question. There's a lot to unwrap there. So I'm beyond the stage now of thinking Bitcoin can fail. I think it's succeeded. It already has succeeded. Not every technology lasts forever. But I already think it's succeeded. Right. Is it still essentially some kind of like perpetual beta? You could argue that, but I think no. I think it's a close to a finished product. It's being improved, but the job it's trying to do of creating censorship resistant money, it's done that, and it's got a very high uptime. When you see Elon Musk invested $1.5 billion of Tesla's money, and you see Jack Dorsey investing $50 million and then $170 million, and MicroStrategy putting hundreds of millions in, and then you see Goldman Sachs saying they're going to offer trading, and Fidelity offering custody. This is a mature community, and it's a mature industry, and it's because the system is, you know, very, very secure now. So now it's here. It's like, okay, where can it go? And there's two things to look at. Firstly, it's like, how big can it be? But also, I think you have to look at, where does the pushback come from the state? So anyone enjoying like Bitcoin and wants to find out more, I recommend a book called The Sovereign Individual. It's a fantastic book. It predicted Bitcoin, and it talks about the information age.
It predates Bitcoin, but
predicts it as well. It predicts a digital form of cryptographic money. We're entering that age now where anyone can really go and live anywhere they want in the world, kind of. Obviously, there's some restrictions. You can't go and live in North Korea. Getting in China is difficult. But, you know, if you want to go and work in China, you find a job, you probably can get there. But that also gives small states or small countries this kind of regulatory arbitrage where they can attract people in. Estonia's done it brilliantly with cryptocurrencies. Malta's done it. We're starting to kind of see it internally in the US with Wyoming and Miami and trying to offer different things. A lot of people during the latest election go, why the hell am I in San Francisco and get shouted at by crackheads? I can go and live in, I can do my same job in Texas and pay no state tax. So we've got this regulatory.
Same thing. I mean, that's exactly what I just did. I mean, I'm in New Hampshire here. Right. I was in New York City for 15 years and it was a party for 15 years. And the last year was like, party's over, and I know I have friends who are like doing some crypto stuff there, and all, you know, stuff is like, lots of websites are restricted because of the regulations. I did something crazy. Rather than get a VPN, I took the train into New Jersey, and I was using certain websites in like Jersey City, the coffee shop, like Shapeshift, I think. You're talking to one of them.
The point I'm trying to get to is like, we've got this changing world now. Bitcoin isn't going away. It's here. Okay. Yeah. So we can talk about the next big battles, and we can all talk about what it will mean. The next big battle is the regulatory side. The most hardened Bitcoiners will talk about the importance of privacy, and they're right. Yeah. We should and deserve to be able to transact privately. And there's so many reasons for that. It's a basic human right, but also because, you know, certain countries buying certain goods can get you arrested. Buying a Bible in certain countries may get you arrested. Making political contributions to charities or political parties could get you arrested. But we all deserve financial privacy. But we don't tend to have it. And it's usually under the guise that, well, yeah, we need to be tracking in case people are giving money to terrorists or funding crime. But whenever you look at actual statistics, it's a very, very small amount. But what's going to happen is, I think the state is gradually, well, it depends on the state. I expect certain states, the likes, as it happened in the Gary V, I mean, he raised it, you know, your Russias, your Brazils, your Indias, your Chinas, to be very hostile towards Bitcoin. I just do, because they're authoritarian. They're authoritarian states, or they're more authoritarian than other places. But I expect them to be very hostile, because why would they want to support an open protocol for money, which they can't control? I mean, Putin is regarded as potentially the richest person in the world, but no one knows where his wealth is, right? Why would he support an open protocol for money? China, for obvious reasons, would never support an open protocol for money. Brazil, potentially, yes, no. But what we've got is places like the US and Europe and UK, rather than banning it, because it's a little bit more difficult now. You know, there's certain arguments that, you know, code is free speech, and why would you ban code? They certainly might make it a bit more difficult. They might require more stringent KYC implementations. They might force people not to be able to use certain things like coin joins, which allows you to obfuscate your transactions. Yeah, there might be certain things they do like that that make it just more and more difficult to use. But Bitcoin is fought many battles, and I think it would clear that battle anyway, because I think other nations will go. I mean, the smart move for a small nation right now is to put Bitcoin on its balance, hold Bitcoin in its reserves, and say we're open to supporting Bitcoin, and then go in public. It become far wealthier nation once it has. But if we get over those hurdles, how far can this go? I don't know. Honestly, I'd be guessing. I don't know if we end up in two worlds. We end up with a bit like when you have those dystopian future films where it's like there's the red, half the world's red and half's blue and they're at war. I don't know if we're going to end up like that, where half the world adopts and uses Bitcoin and the other doesn't. And you have China and Russia transacting using, you know, a digital yuan and, you know, whatever. And you have half the world who's adopted Bitcoin, or you have this mix of dollar Bitcoin. I really don't know. What I do know, what I do expect, is Bitcoin is like gravity, and it will continue to suck people in, because once you've hodled hard money and you've come to understand what hard money means, and you've because it's going to sound hyperbolic, right? And somebody listening to this might be like, oh, he's chatting bollocks. But there is a reality. Once you hold hard money like Bitcoin, you don't want to let it go. And the reason you don't want to let it go is because you know it's pristine collateral. You know it'll be worth a lot more in the future. So you become a little bit more wiser about your spending habits. You can become a little bit more considerate. And therefore, you become a little bit more considerate about other things. I mean, it has for me. So,
yeah, I see that.
So I would just say I expect it continue to grow, continue to draw people in like gravity, as I said. But how big it can go, I don't know. Can it be the world reserve? Yeah, I don't know. I don't even know what world reserve means. I know it's my reserve, and I've got friends who use it as a reserve, and I know it's the reserve for my company. But does it become the world reserve? I don't know.
How do you think about, you know, people who want to go, you know, all in on Bitcoin or be Bitcoin hodlers, and then, you know, you always hear this phrase, you know, not your keys, not your coin. But it seems to me like everybody holding their own keys is it's quite a big responsibility. You might want to lend it out. I mean, I know you have had people on from BlockFi and Abra where, you know, you could lend it out and make more. And then there are some people online saying, well, you shouldn't do that because then you don't, you know, someone else has custody. How do you think about that?
Yeah, another really good question. So for, again, anyone listening who doesn't know this, not your keys, not your coin term. So with Bitcoin, there's no customer service. There's no call center. There's if you've sent a transaction to somebody by mistake, there's no, you know, chargebacks. You become self-sovereign. You hold sovereignty over your money, but you hold responsibility over it. So once you've got that Bitcoin and you're holding it, you are responsible for it. Now, you've got a couple of options. If you buy a Coinbase and leave it on Coinbase, they are sovereign over your money. It is yours, but it's essentially an IOU until you take it out. The way you take it out is you hold it in a hardware wallet, or you hold it in an external wallet of some kind, you know, whether that's multi-sig or whatever. what we refer to that in the industry is once you've taken control of the Bitcoin, you know, once you've got it on your own hardware wallet or your own wallet somewhere, you are holding your private keys. When somebody else is holding it for you, custodying it for you, you're not holding your private keys. So this is what we're talking about. Now, I don't think every single person from day one has to hold their private keys. If someone's listening to this and going, do you know what, I'm going to get into this Bitcoin, and they go on Coinbase and they buy $100 of Bitcoin, you know what, leave it on the Coinbase for now. Just leave it for now. And then go away and learn about Bitcoin and think, is this something you really want to get involved in and get involved in deeply? And then you need to learn about security. But if you get to the point where you're starting to, you know, stack and build up a decent amount of Bitcoin, then you do want to hold your private keys. But like I say, it comes with some responsibility. You know, you have to have a way of backing those up. The next point that you've referred to is, it's a company like BlockFi. So this is a kind of the company which allows you to lend your Bitcoin. You can send them your Bitcoin and they will lend it out and give you some interest. Or you can borrow money against your Bitcoin. Again, you send them some Bitcoin and they'll give you a loan. And when you repay the loan, you get your Bitcoin back. Highly controversial companies. They split the community. Some people are saying, what is the point of giving your Bitcoin to another company to hold for you for 6% interest on an asset, pristine asset that goes up in value? What if that company goes bust? You lose your Bitcoin. Now, back in, I think it was 2011, I'd have to check the year, an exchange called Mt. Gox went bust because 800,000 Bitcoin was stolen.
And that was very traumatic for the Bitcoin community.
Very traumatic. A lot of people lost a lot of Bitcoin and a lot of money. So there's a PTSD with this that people are like, hold your Bitcoin. I think any financial system needs borrowing and lending services. I think it's important. There are different ways of doing it. I would never put all my Bitcoin with a BlockFi. I wouldn't even put over 20%. But I certainly am happy to put a certain amount with them. I trust the service. I think we've got much more mature companies, a way of them custodying it and not losing your Bitcoin. I think we're in a very different place. And right now I do trust them, but I'm always keeping an eye on it. You know, I'm always asking the CEO, Zach Prince, questions, always welcoming him on the show. I'm always listening to feedback. You know, it is a moving feast for me. I'm always keeping an eye on it because if something did happen to them and I lost that Bitcoin, obviously I would be devastated.
Yeah, for sure. I've looked at it. I feel like the chance of that happening for something like BlockFi is far lower. I mean, you know, but again, it's like the Bitcoin Cash people when they say they're taking over, like, I'm not 100% sure that I'm right here. So I think it's safe to, like, you know, spread around your investment a little bit.
Yeah, and do your own research, as we always say.
Yeah. All right. So, we'll start to wrap up. What's in store for 2021 for the What Bitcoin Did podcast? Do you have any, are there any topics that you'd like to cover that you haven't covered yet? Or
just to keep growing, you know, I've just done my numbers for February. It's 724,000 downloads. So like in my head, I'm like, I want to get to a million. Just want to hit a million for a month as a target.
Yeah,
I want to break it out to a few bigger, more mainstream guests. I'd like to get Eric Weinstein on. I'd like Lex Fridman on. You know, I'd like some, you know, Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris, all these big names. Yeah. I'd like to get them on and get their opinion or get them into a debate with some top Bitcoiners. Because I think as part of this going mainstream, you know, that's really important. I'm growing What Bitcoin Did into a platform. I want to make it less about me and more about other voices as well, because, you know, I have one job, which is ask simple questions, but there are some really smart people who can provide, you know, really good content in a different way. I want to make little audio documentary series that tell topics, like tell narrative stories. So I don't know, just keep developing and growing the brand and expanding it. And then I've got little side projects I do as well.
Cool. All right. So as we wrap up, do you have any last thoughts on this? And where can people find your podcast and website and all that?
Well, thank you for having me on, Max. I really appreciate it. I don't usually like to do interviews because I think I'm better at asking questions than answering them. But it's a good test. But I always feel like I'm not the best. But so thank you.
I'm glad you chose to come on to the Local Maximum.
Well, I appreciate you having me on and giving me the chance. Look, if anyone's interested in Bitcoin and wants to learn about Bitcoin, I do have this podcast. It's What Bitcoin Did. You can find it at whatbitcoindid.com. I've got a beginner's guide on there. And then just most weeks, I've just got different types of interviews from technical people or traders. So there's all different types. You'll find the content you like. And if you want to follow me, I'm on Twitter. It's at Peter McCormack. And yeah, just thanks for having me on again, Max. I really enjoyed this.
All right, Peter, thanks for coming on the show.
No worries, buddy. You take care.
All right. All of this will go on the show notes page at localmaxradio.com/165. We have a lot of stuff on deck for you. You know, if you want more crypto, I'm planning on a couple of crypto related episodes. I'm planning on doing a solo show on decentralized finance, DeFi, I think the kids are calling it. And that's an important one to know. So I'll get to that. I also have a guest coming on to talk about timestamping uses in the blockchain. So I'm going to have a couple episodes of that. I'm not sure right now whether I'm going to do it all, you know, next week and the week after, kind of push them all together. Maybe that's a good idea, or whether I want to space it out. I'm going to think about that a little more. In other emerging technology news, I have a great guest on augmented reality coming up for you very soon. And Aaron and I, in addition, are going to do another news update. We're going to talk about the fourth turning, which is really fascinating, kind of, you know, historical, social idea that Neil, it's a book by Neil Howe and William Strauss that came out in the 90s that seemed to predict a lot of what's going on now. So we'll talk about, like, you know, what their theory is. And yeah, I come on at the end of the show and I say, I don't know what we're going to talk about now. There's so many things coming up. This is going to be a very exciting spring for the Local Maximum. Have a great week, everyone. That's the show. To support the Local Maximum, sign up for exclusive content and our online community at maximum.locals.com. The Local Maximum is available wherever podcasts are found. If you want to keep up, remember to subscribe on your podcast app. Also, check out the website with show notes and additional materials at localmaxradio.com. If you want to contact me, the host, send an email to localmaxradio@gmail.com. Have a great week. Feel the power.